Porterville, right? Okay, from Porterville, 3 years in February. Give it up for Josh.
My name is Joshua Morrell. I'm an alcoholic. The first thing I want to say is that I feel privileged to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome the newcomer to Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome anybody on vacation in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd like to welcome anybody who sat in front of that guy with the black dress and had the two worst choices of his life given to him. Either go to jail or come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I remember what that was like. So, I have absolutely no idea what I'm going to say. Actually, that's kind of a lie. I know what I'm going to say, but I don't know what you're going to hear. How about that? You know, when Bill asked me to first speak, it was like 4 months ago, and when he asked me, I was like, well, it's about fucking time. Yeah? I mean, there was a couple other thoughts that went through my head, you know. Then I heard that it was recorded, right? And I was like, well, that's fucking good, because I'm going to say a whole bunch of stuff that people need to hear. And I share that with you because I'm an alcoholic, man. You know, and there's a lot of thoughts that go through my head that don't necessarily correlate with reality. And me thinking that I have something that's important for somebody to share is one of those things. You know what? Anyways, my sobriety date is February 22nd of 2016. The last time I felt it necessary to change the way I feel through any chemical whatsoever was on the 21st of February 2016. I was inside of an institution. I'm sober today because of that pink can. The big book that I carry to every single meeting that I go to, I got while I was in prison. I had an opportunity to read it while I was there for the first time ever. First thing I want to do is I want to apologize to anybody that's going to get offended with part of my story. The most referred to story in Alcoholics Anonymous is page 417, Acceptance is the Key. The part I love about that story is about two pages over from it. The guy talks about figuring out just how much Demerol to shoot into his arm to cover over the tranquilizers to get over the pep pills so that he can get upstairs, down the hallway, into his bed to pass out successfully. In the 12x12 of Alcoholics Anonymous, in the third tradition, it talks about a member knocking on the door in the second year who had no alcohol problem whatsoever. But he understood that people were saving lives in that room, and he was wondering if he could get help. So part of my story has to do with chemicals. I like to change the way I feel. I like to change the way I feel through anything that I can. My alcohol of choice is more, preferably more of yours. And it took me to places that I would never wish anybody to have to go to. So, my life was pretty normal. I have no idea who my mom is or my dad is. My mom abandoned me while I was three. My grandparents abandoned me when I was six, and I was raised by my aunt. So, pretty normal life, right? I don't know why, but for some reason, I felt like I didn't fit in for my entire life. The easiest way to describe it is if anybody's ever walked into a room about 3 seconds after the joke has ended, and there's still a couple chuckles and there's some smiles on people's face, and you just know that you missed something. Well, that's how I felt my entire life. I did a lot of things to try and gain self-acceptance. And the easiest way was through negative behavior. And I'll describe it really quick. The way that I, the limit that I went to for self-acceptance and for acceptance of others was I have a tattoo of a camel on my toe. And I did it for just that reason right there. Okay? Literally. I did it for that reason. That little chuckle and that joke, because now I feel like I'm accepted. Right? So, I had my first taste of alcohol at about 11. I just remember the room was spinning, and I remember that, I remember a bunch of other feelings that came with it, but the real feeling that I felt is I felt like I was a part of it for the first time. There's a couple of things I don't remember. I don't know about you guys. I don't remember the first time that I was ever able to jump. Right? Like, I don't know if anybody's ever seen a kid try to jump. Right? And then when they finally do, it's like the highlight of their life. Like, they can't believe it. It's extraordinary. Like, I don't remember that. Okay? I don't remember what it was like to ride a bike for the first time. I have a vague recollection of the girl that I lost my virginity to. I don't really remember my first kiss. I don't remember the first baseball that I hit. But I remember the sound of methamphetamine cracking on a signed autograph of Jerry Rice. I remember the weather that was outside the day it was. I remember it was the middle of November. There was just enough fog to get from the schoolroom to the edge of the schoolyard and outside of the fence without anybody seeing. And I share that because I remember what it was like to finally think I found what was going to make me whole. And I did a lot of alcohol along with that all the time. It was always there. It was the easiest thing. It was actually the first thing that I ever remember stealing. Back when Mary's Vineyard had a long drugstore, I remember Smirnoff Twisted, I think it was. Anyways, I am completely freaking nervous right now. I just have to share that with you guys, you know? So, I'm not the kind of alcoholic that a lot of my friends were. I had a lot of friends that were able to party just as hard as I was, and at some point in their life, they were able to stop, put their life together. Now they have, like, successful lawyer careers and stuff like that, and it's like, that fucker used just like me. Right? Like, that doesn't make any sense. Right? Like, what? How did he stop? And at 15 years old, right, when I found that unique sound and that feeling, I became homeless instantly by choice. I would rather drink and smoke cigarettes and do all that other fun stuff because I thought that I was going to be an outlaw, right? I thought that I was going to have to listen to any rules. Nobody got to tell me what I needed to do. So being homeless at 15 is not really a bad problem until you need a place to sleep and a sandwich. And one of those times that I was getting a place to sleep and a sandwich, so I was offered a come on over, we'll chill, we'll just stay the night. And so I was 15 years old, this man was 35, and suddenly it wasn't a night anymore, it was like a month later. And I'm going to share about this because I know that there's a lot of people in this room that don't understand that this is a large part of why I continue to drink. So, after about a month of just doing whatever, I remember that suddenly he was touching me in a manner that I didn't really know what it was about. And I know that I allowed it to happen. And I know that for a first time, I started feeling like I was a part of. Right? Like I got the same feeling from that act that I got from alcohol and I got from drugs. So I was sexually molested at 15 years old and a willing participant of that. And it was completely okay until people started to find out. And then it became an elaborate story of how I was raped. And I continued to use that for years. And I continued to get loaded over that for years. And I would like to say that it stopped right there, but that feeling of being accepted in any form, in any manner, carried a lot in my life. I wish that I could say that I was smart enough to have hooked, right? To have been a hooker in my life. But the reality is that I did anything for the chance of getting high. Not even the guarantee. And I continued to do that for years, and I wasn't really argumentative about the choice of sexual identity that those people had. So at 18 years old, I went to county jail for the first time. I was in Modesto. I got out of county jail, and I thought that, I don't know, man, I'm completely lost right now. I have no idea why I shared about that. I know that it doesn't have fear over me today. I know that it doesn't control me, and it doesn't control me because I was able to do this wonderful thing called a four-step with my sponsor. I know who I am today. I know what I want today. And I know the things that I'm willing to do to be that person today. You know, and that's only because of Alcoholics Anonymous that I know who I am. So I found the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous in 2005. I was fresh out of prison. I know I skipped a little bit. It was a meeting in Fresno. It was a Wednesday. It was a noon meeting. And I was loaded. I don't know how you guys are. I don't know if there's anybody in this room that's crazy enough to use when they're inside of a treatment program or not. Okay? But that made perfectly good sense to me, right? You know? So I go to this meeting, right, for this 12-step meeting, and I see these people laughing. And I see them hugging. And I hear him asking my name, and hear him telling me to come back. There wasn't a whole lot of places in my life that was telling me to come back at that point. Before I went to prison for the first time, my family talked to me behind closed doors, and my friends acted like they weren't home. The craziest thing about that 12-step meeting, right, is that I didn't have to have anything in my pocket to belong. The only thing that was required was that I said my name and that I wanted to try as hard as I could to not drink anymore. I wish that I could say that I stayed sober back then, but I didn't. What happened is I actually graduated that treatment program successfully, right, while I was using it, right, successfully graduated. And I went to this sober living that was on Court Street, and I would go to meetings at the Alano Club, and then I would go home, and I would pass right by the sober living, and I would go to my mom's house, and I would have a couple beers, right? Because why not? No, I don't have a problem with that. It's legal. So I struggled in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. And then I actually started to get sober for the very first time. I got checked into Pine in December of 2005, and they gave me that 90-day push that I needed. You know, and I started looking good in the mirror. I don't know if you guys relate to that or not. And girls started looking at me, so I thought that I had arrived. And then I got a job, and they started paying me to show up, and I knew that I had arrived. And all of a sudden, all the outside, right, became all the work that I was willing to do. Right? Because if I could just get the right old lady and I could get the right job and I could get the right car and I could sound really good at a meeting, then I was going to be all right. I didn't know that if I didn't work on that stuff that I just shared a little bit ago, that I would continue to use in this program and I would continue to drink in this program. And so I got myself a nice little fiance. I don't know if you guys relate to that or not. You know, she had about 5 months sober, and I had about like 6.5. And at that point in time, I knew that I had something to share, right? And I was trying to give it to her. And I got my first apartment. I got my first car. And then she said she wasn't sure anymore. So like all good alcoholics who get their feelings hurt, I told her that if she wasn't sure anymore, then she needed to be not sure here, right? And she needed to be not sure in our car, or she could come and get her baby and be not sure somewhere else. And then I went and found another newcomer that had about, oh, I don't know, what's she have, about 25 days, I think? And so I was 18 months sober at the time, right? And she had about 25 days, and she was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen in my life. Because she wanted me. And and we got married, right? I've known her for about 3 weeks. And we got married. And it was going to be wonderful and awesome. And I really don't know where it went wrong. I don't, man. And I did even more than that, right? Like, I married her on the same day that I was supposed to marry that other girl. And then, not only did I do that, but I drove past the home of that other girl with just married on the car and read my engine really loud. There's a couple of those people in this room that remember me from back then, right? I had this 1990 Toyota Corolla, and it had about a 6-inch pipe on the back of it, and it was really, really loud. And I was just driving. So I got injured at work. I got my chest cut open, and I got put in a hospital for about 3 weeks. And I was on a bunch of medication, and and I became an asshole, right? I got a taste of that stuff that I love. I don't know if you guys relate to this or not, going to the hospital and getting that free stuff that we love. And, yeah. So I got loaded when my wife cheated on me. And God forbid. And, and I proceeded to go on a matter of about a couple of years where I couldn't get 2 or 3 days together. And what happened was I would go through this pain and humiliation, and I would come back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I would tell you guys how horrible it was, and I would tell you how I was done, and I was willing to do whatever it took, and this was the most horrible thing. And then next week I would come back in and I would say the exact same thing, right? And I would have people look at me and go, "Hey, you might want to work the steps." And I would go, "Yeah, that sounds great, but let me tell you what happened." And then I would tell them what happened, and they would tell me, "You might want to work the steps." And I would go, "Yeah, but let me tell you what happened." And finally, in 2009, I had a really bad, I had what I thought was a really bad relapse. I got drunk and Visalia, and somehow ended up in Clark County Detention Center in Vegas. Had no real memory of where I was. I know that I was in Vegas for like a month and a half. I never saw the script. You can kind of figure out what I was doing. And I remember I broke into this car and I had stolen this $40. Well, it was more than $40. I had stolen this Garmin navigation system, right? And I had already done it once or twice, and I knew exactly how much money I was going to get for it at the pawn shop. I was going to get $40. So I went to court, and they pulled my California record, and my California record has everything to do with auto burglaries, and Las Vegas doesn't really like people from California breaking the law, and they said, we're going to get you for the Habitual Criminal Act, carries 21 to life for $40. And I wish that I could tell you that there was some elaborate story, like I got on my knees and I asked God to like do something, but I didn't. Right? I went to court the next week. My public defender had done some rigmarole, and they were going to let me out on drug court. And I remember the judge looked at me and he said, I'm going to let you out, right? It was a Friday. I'm going to let you out, and you're going to report to drug court on Monday. And if you don't, I'm going to take away your deal. And I remember standing in front of that judge, and I remember my being shackled, and I remember promising that judge, yes, I will be there. He said, if you do any type of drinking or using in the meantime, I'm going to take away your deal. And I said, I will not drink, Your Honor. Then I remember walking down like the 30-foot corridor of chain, right, from the door, from the Sallyport to the actual sidewalk. And I remember in that 30 feet, I had decided exactly what house I was going to, what I was going to use, how I was going to cry my way into a bag. And pretty soon it was 2 weeks later, and I had no idea what to do. So I ran from Las Vegas, and I came back to California. Right? To mom's house. I don't know if anybody of you guys relate to that, right? Being this big tough gangster and going to mom's house. My mom was actually dying. She had stage 4 cancer, and she was on hospice already, and she didn't even know who I was. And I came back, right, not only to try and save my own ass, but also I had a new girlfriend that I had gotten right before I had gone to Vegas, and I knew that she was over here using, and I had to save her. And I did, right? I did. I found her, and she broke the windshield of the truck with her bare hands, and she tore the visors off and threw them at me, and it was horrible, and it was good, and it was So I got enrolled in, I think it was called Preventative Services, and I started going to groups, and I started going back to meetings, because I knew that if I stayed in meetings, my life would get better. And I remember renting a couch from a guy that was in recovery. And I remember finally convincing her to leave Tulare and come kick in that living room with me. And, well, when I mean kick, I mean like to kick the opiates that she was doing. And also just to kick it. And then I remember getting a job. And I remember finally calling my public defender in Las Vegas. Right? Because some members in this program told me that, but the last thing I wanted to do was build a life on the run. And then I had to go and be courageous enough to tell them what I had done. And some members of this fellowship, on their own accord, drove me all the way to Vegas and sat there and waited with me. And we saw this judge. And this judge passed out like 814 years before she saw me. I mean, Vegas just gives out years for like, this guy did jaywalking 35 years. And I was like, what the fuck? So I knew that I was going to jail. I knew it was over. I couldn't believe that they had talked me into doing this. And the judge said, I don't care. That program's not going to be good enough. You have to do drug court. And luckily, one of the members of the fellowship that had gone over there with me was a counselor in a drug court program, and he had already talked to the judge prior to, and so I was allowed to do drug court over here in Tulare County. The only problem was that they didn't have a number on me, they didn't have a file, they didn't have a case, so I remember sitting in front of Judge Payton and him saying that if I messed up one time, he couldn't sanction me, because I would be lost in the system, and so I had zero tolerance. And I successfully completed drug court. Right? And I got a job, and then I got a career, and then pretty soon I didn't need to go to a meeting. Right? And then I would come home from work, and I would look at that certificate, and I would go, yeah, you're good. And the wife would say, this is a new wife, by the way, not the same one, because I had divorced her. Right? And this is the one that I came back to save, okay? So we had kids together, and I would work all week long. The career that I do, I work a lot, which is actually the reason why I was like 2 or 3 minutes late. I got off work late. And so I came home from work one day, and I think it was a Friday, and it was a meeting that I always went to on Friday night. And I remember her saying, but you've been at work for like 14 days straight. Can't you just stay home one night? And I said, okay, sure. And then the next weekend came along, and she said, you haven't had a chance to play with the kids in a month. Can you just stay home and play with the kids? And I said, okay. And then pretty soon I wasn't going to any meeting at all. And about 6 months went by with no meetings, no talking to my sponsor, nothing. And I came home from work one day, and she said, you know, we haven't been to a meeting in about 6 months. And you got 2.5 years. Clean. Sober. We can probably drink. Now, the last thing I'm trying to do is blame this on her. Okay? Don't get me wrong. But when she said that, what I heard was, drink with me or I'll leave you. So yeah, sure, we can drink. And like every successful alcoholic that's not an alcoholic, we decided to set ground rules. Right? Because setting rules on how you're going to drink does not make you alcoholic. Right? So we had these wonderful ground rules. We were only going to drink the same amount. First, we were only going to buy a 6-pack, right? Because if we bought a 12-pack, that was alcoholic. So we're going to buy a 6-pack. We're only going to drink on weekends. We're both going to drink the same amount. And that's it. Okay, cool. And those were really good rules. I mean, they did a great job for about 2 weeks. Okay? So I'm an alcoholic. Once I start to drink, I want more. So by the second weekend that we had, I would be done with beer two and be wanting beer three. And she would be like 2 sips into beer two. And she would go to use the restroom. So I would down hers really quick, right? So that she would come out and go, oh, I guess I need my third one. And I'd be like, I'll get it for you. And then it was like a Tuesday night, and I was picking up pizza and beer, right? Gotta have pizza and beer. So I brought home pizza, and I brought home just a tall can, right? Just one tall can, and she flipped out because I had broke the rules, right? So I opened it up, and I poured it down the drain, and see, I'm not an alcoholic because I poured alcohol down the drain. And then that weekend, we drank again like normal with our set rules. And I think it was Sunday morning, I woke up and I came out of the bedroom. And I remember that she had gone to sleep early, and I remember that I had walked to the store. Right? To get more. And I had hid the bottles outside. What I didn't know, she let me know when I came out of the bedroom, was what happened to your eye. And I suddenly remembered the bus stop sign. So apparently, I was either during the second trip or third trip to the store, I decided to not learn how to walk, and I hit a bus stop sign, and didn't even really remember until the next day. So I share about that, right, because it progressed to where pretty soon I had a beer fridge, and I was drinking every single night, and I was convincing myself that it was okay because I had done this wonderful thing of building a career. And I thought that it was okay because I was a good provider. And we had gone from this cheap little apartment to where I was actually purchasing my own home. And the drinking didn't matter because my boss drank and my coworkers drank and everybody drank, right? And it made me fit in better and it made me a part of better. So I bought my own home. It was in 2014. I remember that I would come home from work, and I'm a welder by trade, so I'm always covered with dirt and grease, and I would change in the garage, and I would grab a couple beers out of the beer fridge, and I would walk out the side door, and I would walk around back, and I would move the chair just between the window and the French door so that I couldn't be seen, and I would start to drink. And I would hear my family inside, you know, living, and I would sit outside and I would drink because I felt like I didn't deserve it. And pretty soon they would finally notice that I was home, and I was 6 or 7 beers into it. And I don't know about you guys, but I don't want to be a father 6 or 7 beers into it. And I would stop spending time with my kids, and I would drink until I could finally go to sleep, because the noise was just so loud, right? The noise that said that you weren't worth it, that you didn't deserve this, that you should just kill yourself, was too loud. And I would do that every single night. You know, along with drinking comes arguments, and we had a couple arguments which led to gigantic physical altercations, because I don't know about you guys, but I'm the guy that likes to drink, and then I like to hit women back. There's no excuse for it. It's part of my story, it's part of who I am, and if I'm not honest about it, then I'm hiding something. So, one of these times, one of these arguments, he decided to push me in a pool fully clothed, right? And I don't know about you, but that was pretty fun. So I got up out of that pool and I decided to show her, right? I'm going to show her. And I went down the street to a friend's house, and I stuck a needle in my arm for the first time in 7 years. And that was in October of 2014. And on March 16th of 2015, in a methamphetamine-induced psychosis, I heard voices in the attic that were trying to kill my family, and I lit my own house on fire. Started an argument with my wife to get the kids and make her leave. I boarded up the exits to the attic, and I lit the house on fire because I was going to get the voices that were trying to kill my family. So I woke up on March 17th in jail, and I had singes on my hands, the smell of smoke still in my hair. I had hair at the time, and it's all right, I used to like it too. And and the sudden realization of what I had done to my children set in. See, because every relapse that I had talked to you about before, I was always only hurting myself. I had never had children in the mix that were now suffering because of my decisions. And you would think that waking up in county jail with like that much going on and that much pain and that much misery, that that would be enough. And it was enough. Until I hit prison and somebody came along and said they had some codeines for sale, and then I don't know about you, but I gotta buy those codeines. And then I got to prison, right, and grandma started supporting me. Because I don't know about you guys, but I'm Grandma Snookums, so grandma sends me money. So grandma's money started going to the connection that was in prison. And I continued to manipulate and to lie and to do everything that most of us alcoholics do to our families. February 21st of 2016, I remember almost getting in a fight over this amount of heroin that was like nothing. And we call it a smear in prison. And And I remember putting a hole in my arm for no reason. And I remember sitting there looking on this pancake rack, realizing that I was going to live the rest of my life under the influence. And I felt the worst fear I'd ever felt in my life. At that point in time, dying was not the fear. It was the fear that I was never going to be able to recover. It was the fear that I was going to live in that pain, and I was going to live in that worthlessness, and that there was nothing I could do about it. And I said this thing, I don't even know if it was a prayer. I just know that I said, you have to do something, whoever you are, because I need help. And I remember that I woke up on the 22nd of February of 2016, and I did not feel like changing the way I felt for the first time in my life. A couple weeks later, I got transferred out of that facility, and I landed in Soledad. It's a prison on the Central Coast. It has wonderful weather for summer. I'm not saying you need to go there, but if you do go to prison, check that spot out. The great part about that facility is the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that it has there. I have a schedule still from the institution, from the fellowship there, and there's about 18 meetings a month, which is unheard of for meetings in jail. And I met my sponsor in that prison. His name is Chris Watnick. He was serving a life sentence for a drug-related homicide. He just recently paroled about 8 or 9 months ago. And I would love to tell you that I talk to him on a regular basis, but I don't. But I talk to him as much as I need to. And he got me started on the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous that I had never really heard of. Like, I had been in meetings for a long time. I said that I came to the first 12-step program in 2005. And I had heard about steps, right? But I had never really done steps. I had those sponsors that I used to call drive-by sponsors, right? And what I mean was, when I would drive by, like, the Alano Club, I would go, oh, there's my sponsor. And I wondered why I felt no relief, right? So my sponsor started me on a course of vigorous action as outlined in the book. And I remember I did a third step in a gymnasium in prison with about 200 men around, probably about 125 of them lifers. And we did this third step. We got on our knees and we read the third step prayer of Alcoholics Anonymous. And then he outlined me on this fourth step, and I learned that there was a my part to the resentments. I didn't know that. I thought that I was just supposed to make a list of all the people I was mad at and what they had done to me. And so when I got to this my part aspect, it was thoroughly, thoroughly revealing. I also learned that there was a fears list in the fourth step. I had no idea that there was a fears list in the fourth step. I also learned that there was a sexual inventory in the fourth step that has nothing to do with sex. And I was like, what? And then I learned that there was this sexual ideal, which you get to figure out exactly what you want. You know, and I did this fifth step with my sponsor, and I shared some of those things that I shared in the very beginning of this meeting. And I shared those things on a prison yard with another prison inmate. And those are things that, from the place where I came from, I stabbed people over. While I was in the middle of doing it, or having done it in my past before. And the amazing thing that happened, right, is that the next meal that I had with my sponsor, he still sat down at the other side of the table. And this fear of being found out, and this fear of being lost and killed and all that stuff didn't happen. And for the first time in my life, I was able to walk through fear without changing the way I felt. The next thing my sponsor had me do was start sponsoring other men. It's a crazy idea. Never really heard of it. You know, like, here was men helping other men suffer, right, and work these steps so that we don't die alone. And that's what I did, man. And my life has successfully gotten better a day at a time. So, I don't know if I've shared anything that's been of a significant value to anybody. If it was, I hope you write it down. Sorry, that was a joke that I don't think I get. So, we're about out of time, which is really, really good. Because I like can't even swallow right now. Look, I'm going to share what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. And I don't know if anybody's going to relate to this, because this is a really weird thing for me. It had really never happened until I had started working like my ninth step. So tonight after this meeting, I'm going to go home. All right? And I'm going to lay my head on my pillow. And I'm going to go to sleep. I'm not going to pass out in some weird place around some weird people doing weird things. And tomorrow morning, I'm going to wake up. I'm not going to come to in a gigantic panic where I have to suddenly check all my pockets. Right? And I'm not going to wake up surrounded by a bunch of strange people in some strange place doing strange things. And then I'm going to go brush my teeth in this mirror that I get to look into. And that right there was something that I had never done for a long time. I brushed my teeth with the lights off because I didn't want to see the person because I was completely ashamed. And today I love light, especially in a bathroom. Let's get some more in there. You know what I mean? Because I love being able to look at the person that I'm becoming today. So if you want relief from alcoholism on a level that surpasses more than just not drinking, I suggest that you get a sponsor and you work the steps. It's the only thing that has worked for an alcoholic like me. Of course, I'm an alcoholic that drinks against my own will. So maybe you have a choice. I don't. Thank you guys for inviting me. And,